Who would have guessed that number two on the bestseller list this summer would be an intellectual thriller starring four brainy Princeton seniors and a 15th century manuscript written in code? Ian Caldwell and Dustin Thomason wrote The Rule of Four not long after they got out of college themselves. They based it on an obscure but real manuscript, the Hypnerotomachia Polyphili. It's been called the most unreadable book in the world, and there's no question it has one of the most unpronounceable titles. Ian Caldwell.
The end of our senior year of college, we had started to talk about taking a road trip together around the country, and the idea somehow came to us that we would write a book while we were on the road. And around the same time, we realized we needed a hook to hang the story on. And I happened to be taking a Renaissance history class at Princeton, for which I studied a book called The Hypnerotomachia Polyphili. And the more research we did on the Hypnerotomachia, the more we thought this is the perfect thing to hang the story on.
It's an extraordinary book for you to choose for that purpose. I mean, most people have never heard of it. There must have been something special about it that caught your attention right away.
There were several things, actually. One of the curiosities about it is that nobody's exactly sure who wrote it. At the same time, there's a code built into the book composed of the first letter of every chapter that, when strung together, forms a message that seems to suggest the author's identity.
It's written in how many different languages?
It's written in six different languages, at least six different languages. And also, there are invented words. Hypnerotomachia itself is an invented word. And there are invented hieroglyphics in addition to the six or so languages that it's written in.
What does the standard scholarship suggest is the reason for it to have been put together from so many different sources?
Nobody seems to know for sure. There was a tendency among Renaissance intellectuals to want to sort of preen like peacocks and show off everything that they knew, so that the more languages you knew, the more disciplines you'd mastered, the more you could pack into this encyclopedic demonstration of your wisdom, which is kind of par for the course, I think, during that period. But the strange thing is to wrap all of this into what is purportedly a love story, which is really what the Hypnerotomachia supposedly is, and then somehow to find a way to get the most important printer in all of Renaissance Italy to print it for you and to hire artists to produce beautiful woodcuts so that the entire book is actually not only very mysterious, but one of the most valuable in the history of Western printing.
It is a work of art, and there are not very many copies of it, I take it.
That's right. There are about 260 copies of it that are known in the world, including the one that is in the rare books room at the Princeton University Library.
Where does the Hypnerotomachia fit into the story of the Rule of Four?
The story is of four Princeton roommates who are in their senior year of college studying the Hypnerotomachia, one of whom is writing his senior thesis on the Hypnerotomachia. And when they begin to realize that there is a secret embedded in the text of this ancient manuscript, they start to try to uncode what that secret might be and ultimately realize that they're not the first to glimpse the secret when another student who is also researching the Hypnerotomachia is murdered on campus.
Give me an example of one of the riddles that you created to decode the Hypnerotomachia.
I think the first riddle that they encounter asks the question, why does Moses have horns? That's actually, it developed out of a Renaissance art class that I'd taken in which there's a statue of Moses created by Michelangelo in which Moses has two horns, two little goat horns at the top of his head, which introduced me to what was actually a pretty prevalent way of showing Moses in Renaissance art. And the question became, why on earth would Moses have horns? The idea of it develops out of a mistranslation of the Bible, because when St. Jerome translated the Bible into Latin, there's a portion in Exodus when Moses descends from the mountain, and the text says that his face shone with rays of light. The scholarly position on this is that Jerome did not want to suggest that Moses was shining with light, because that was a characteristic that Jerome felt should be exclusive to Jesus Christ, so that Jerome advanced a secondary translation of the original Hebrew, according to which, instead of rays of light, the word karen, I think, which is the Hebrew word, was translated as horns, so that Moses descends the mountain with horns. And because of that mistranslation, it was very prevalent in Renaissance art to show Moses with horns, and that becomes the solution to that first riddle.
Once they do begin to decipher the content of the book, they are led directly to a period in Renaissance history, this conflict between religion and humanism?
I think it was that conflict, actually, that generated our interest in connecting the Hypnerotomachia to this period in history. That conflict is actually one of the most central elements of the historical period. It is kind of the zeitgeist of the late 15th century. Just as the Renaissance is boiling over into the Reformation, you have this conflict between humanists who are interested in pagan or classical knowledge and in this kind of Promethean quest to say that humans are capable of anything, which is conflicting with a more medieval paradigm of the conception of human beings as God's creation and playing a role within creation, within God's chain of creation, such that humans need to understand their place within the chain and not be ambitious for more than their role. And the conflict of these two things and the sense among some Christians that the humanist side of things is really destructive and pagan and unchristian creates some of the wonderful struggles that we tried to mine a little bit in The Rule of Four.
It's not so completely different from our own age either, is it?
I think that's true, and I think that this struggle between the religious aspects of people's lives and the sort of humanist aspects of people's lives as people search for meaning in their own lives is one that we can all sort of sympathize with. And in some ways, a lot of that hasn't really changed. I think to bring up another book that we're big fans of, The Da Vinci Code, there was a pretty obvious tension between the people who were interested in this book for the kind of Da Vinci side humanist aspects and the rabid Christian response that he received as a result of creating this fictional story.
Now, you wrote this rule, you began writing The Rule of Four anyway, before The Da Vinci Code was published, but it has been connected in people's minds. Has it bothered you to be connected?
You know, we're absolutely flattered by the comparison. I mean, we think that in some ways they're different kinds of books, but we're both big fans of The Da Vinci Code, and we both think that the central idea of The Da Vinci Code is an incredibly powerful one. People have responded so well to that book. To hear readers say that they think that our book is like that book is an incredible compliment.
So the two of you have finished this book. You're touring now. Do you have time to think about what comes next?
We've been taking every spare moment while we've been on the road to talk about our second book, and we are committed to writing it together, and we've actually gotten a pretty good head start on it in the time between when we finished the final draft of The Rule of Four and when it actually came out. So,
you guys worry about this ever? I mean, you've been friends since, what, the third grade? This could put a lot of pressure on you.
I think it at times can be difficult to work with someone who is your best friend, and yet at the same time, it's also kind of a dream come true. I mean, I think to only have really one partner in your professional life and to have that partner be somebody that you've known since you were 8 years old and really get along with and have struggled with and have, you know, fought a million times and beat each other up a million times, I think it's really rewarding at the end of the day to spend your life doing something with a person like that.
Dustin Thomason and Ian Caldwell's first novel is called The Rule of Four.